The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
All the men, all the guns, all the sacrifice, all in vain. Vietnam is gone, lost to the communists. Make no mistake about that. Oh, they still fight over the corpse, and we look at the bleeding remains via living room television. It's been so much in the news lately, we're all just about sick of it. The orphans, which weren't really orphans, the incredible crash of the C-5A, the battlefields that we saw over 12 years. Now, just so many more names in history as America bled itself dry, both monetarily as well as the blood of our young sons, husbands, and the young men, more than 56,000 of them, who died for that same territory that President Thieu gave to the enemies in only a few short weeks. It's all just so much trauma and agony today, but I think in retrospect we ought to take a look at the bleeding corpse of South Vietnam and ask the question, was it really worth it all? Where did we go wrong? Are we under some strange sort of a curse? Why could not America win in Vietnam? Have we, in fact, won our last war? You know, the questions in retrospect are enormous to the United States, the once proud United States of America, coming to the sickening realization that all of these incredible sacrifices, more than 56,000 dead over 12 years of involvement, $146 billion, and that figure, of course, varies according to who's reporting it from time to time, all of that expenditure, and yet the tragic news of the fall of Vietnam, nevertheless. Sir Robert Thompson, a Britisher who has served as an advisor on Vietnam to United States governments, insisted that the South Vietnam domino was at last toppling. He said, and I quote, "American withdrawal from Indochina is the greatest retreat the world has seen since Napoleon himself retreated from Moscow." Peace with honor, so went the headlines when American troops were finally evacuated from South Vietnam back in 1973. But there was no real peace. The fighting continued, and there was certainly very little, if any, honor. How did it all happen? How did we become involved in Vietnam in the first place? Following World War II, the United States emerged as the number one power in the world. Yet our attention was soon drawn to the threat of Russian expansion in Southeast Asia, and by 1950, the United States had embarked on an ever-escalating involvement in Vietnam. By 1955, U.S. advisors were training the South Vietnamese Army. By 1961, the Joint Chiefs of Staff estimated that 40,000 U.S. servicemen would be needed to clear up the Viet Cong threat. The Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964 provoked the first American attack on North Vietnamese territory when 64 air sorties against four PT boat bases occurred. Then, in March 1965, U.S. Marines landed in South Vietnam, the first U.S. combat unit in Indochina. The United States also began Operation Rolling Thunder, as it was called, a sustained carpet bombing of North Vietnam by giant B-52 stratofortresses. At the end of 1965, the war had escalated to the point that 181,000 troops were stationed there. Militarily, then, 1966 marked a turning point in the war. Hanoi and Haiphong were bombed for the first time. By 1969, 3 years later, U.S. troops in Vietnam peaked at 540,000 and tens of billions of dollars were being spent on military equipment and aid. But political pressures, violent dissent at home, and congressional cutbacks of funds forced an eventual American withdrawal. By 1972, the war in South Vietnam was turned over to the Vietnamese. It was called Vietnamization, a slogan of the day. And nothing, not even a new North Vietnamese offensive, was allowed to interfere with the timetable for winding down America's role in the war. And as one military spokesman said, the United States is dumping the war back into Saigon's lap. Finally, in January 1973, after 4 years of stormy negotiations, Henry Kissinger and Lee Duc Tho, North Vietnam's special envoy, put their initials on a ceasefire agreement. Both sides had made concessions. The United States did not insist on the withdrawal of North Vietnamese troops from South Vietnam, and North Vietnam agreed to an international control commission to supervise the so-called ceasefire. In order to gain the release of American prisoners of war, the United States agreed to clear the mines which blockaded Haiphong Harbor during the final stages of the conflict. On March 28, 1973, United States troops withdrew by air from the sprawling multi-million dollar base at Da Nang as part of a massive exodus that left billions of dollars of military weapons and supplies in the supposedly safe hands of the South Vietnamese Army. Then, one day later, on March 29th, in a brief and simple ceremony at Saigon's Tan Son Nhut Air Base, the United States Army officially entered its role in South Vietnam. The 15-minute formality was the last act in the drama that brought more than 2.5 million American servicemen to South Vietnam in 12 years of bitter fighting. "The long war is over. Peace with honor," shouted the headlines, but for Americans, the peace announcement was a hollow victory. There wouldn't be any great ticker tape parades for returning U.S. troops, no hero's welcome for a job well done, no real satisfaction for a giant sacrifice. Vietnam had become one of the worst nightmares, traumas, and tragedies in all of American history. And when you really look at the statistics, they are absolutely staggering. In the Indochina War, American deaths total over 56,000. That's about 1.5 times the number killed in Korea. Over 300,000 of our young men were wounded in action, second only to World War II. While the delegates to the Paris peace talks were arguing about the size and shape of the peace table, thousands continued to die in Vietnam. In fact, 58% of American combat injuries and 55% of our battle deaths occurred after the Paris peace talks began, exactly like in Korea. Most of the bloody battles you remember, such as Bloody Ridge and Bunker Hill and Pork Chop Hill, some of those made into famous movies, occurred after the beginning of peace negotiations at Panmunjom. We dropped over 7,100,000 tons of bombs in the Indochina War, more than any other conflict in all of man's history, and 3 times the total bomb tonnages expended in World War II. Vietnam was also our longest war, 12 years versus less than 4 years for the Second World War. And Vietnam was incredibly costly. For a limited war with so-called limited objectives, for which we have absolutely nothing to show today, not even honor, we spent some $170 billion total, half the total global conflict of World War II. A firm made up of several large United States companies poured enough concrete during 10 years of construction work in South Vietnam to build a wall 2 feet wide and 5 feet high completely around the country in what was the largest construction program in the history of all of mankind. Enough asphalt was used during the period to pave a 5,500-mile highway from Paris to Saigon. Enough earth was moved to leave a hole 1/4 mile square, and enough rocks, 48 million tons, were used to make ballast for a railroad running halfway around the world. In addition to this, the United States government built 6 deep-water ports, 8 shallow-draft ports, 8 big jet air bases with 12 new 10,000-foot runways. And incidentally, 3 of these major jet airways were, at the height of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, busier in terms of day-to-day traffic than Chicago's O'Hare, which is the busiest airfield in the United States of America. Now, like a recurring nightmare, the war in Southeast Asia is once again very much in the news, only this time, in 1975, there seems to be nothing we can do to save what little remains of Vietnam or of our billions of dollars in materiel. The unexpected success of the communist spring blitzkrieg is almost unbelievable. In less than 30 days, the North Vietnamese conquered what 56,000 American soldiers in 10 years of bloody fighting died to protect. It all began on March 10th with a Viet Cong attack and capture of a single central highland province. 3 days later, President Tu unexpectedly ordered a withdrawal from all the highlands, and the refugees started fleeing with the retreat of South Vietnamese forces. On March 17th, 7 days after the first communist offensive, more provinces fell to the North Vietnamese, including Quang Tri, the northernmost province. By March 23rd, the North Vietnamese, with hundreds of Russian-made tanks and 130-millimeter artillery pieces, swept over 3 more provinces for a total of 10. The ancient and once beautiful city of Hue, with its many temples, gardens, and palaces, fell to the communist onslaught as Thieu's army crumbled into a headlong retreat. The massive pullback by South Vietnamese government forces from the Central Highlands and around Hue had turned hundreds of thousands of frightened refugees fleeing their homes into the largest exodus of Vietnam since 1954. 75 miles of Highway 1 between Hue and Da Nang became clogged with refugees and troops. Although the South Vietnamese High Command still calls it a tactical withdrawal, it can more accurately be described as a complete rout. By March 30th, three more provinces fell to the communists. Da Nang, South Vietnam's second largest city, also succumbed, along with it, the prized and terribly expensive American military installations. In addition, 100,000 South Vietnamese soldiers seeking escape from the offensive were cut off and captured at Da Nang. These frenzied soldiers shot, kicked, raped, and drowned countless thousands of civilians as they battled the refugees to board the last aircraft and barges before communist forces could overwhelm them. By April 3rd, 75% of Vietnam was lost to the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. At least six of South Vietnam's 13 divisions had been lost through casualties, capture, or simply fragmenting and coming apart, and desertion. Around $5 to $10 billion worth of American planes, ammunition, tanks, helicopters, heavy artillery, and installations had been abandoned in the wake of President Thieu's great retreat. South Vietnam's Air Force, fourth largest in the world before the spring offensive, is no more. With her troops lacking discipline and determination, and with about half of South Vietnam's 20 million population living either in captured territory or as refugees, the mood was very depressing and ugly in Saigon. And the most bitter irony of all is that the South Vietnamese, in their frustration, began to blame the Americans for these devastating setbacks.
For 40 years, the Plain Truth magazine has been supplying the missing dimension in education. The Plain Truth is published monthly as a facet of Ambassador College's in-the-home educational service. It maintains an editorial policy that incorporates this missing dimension in education, biblical understanding. The Plain Truth's timely, informative articles deal with subjects covering success in business, recreation, politics, religion, farming. Each issue not only documents the state of today's society, but offers hope for a better world tomorrow. To serve its more than 6 million readers, The Plain Truth is published in 5 languages and is available without price or obligation to all who request it. Join the growing worldwide readership. Request your subscription to the magazine with a 40-year history of educational service to mankind. The Plain Truth. Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales, 2001.
This current number, by the way, is loaded with articles of very incisive reporting about the debacle in South Vietnam and Indochina and America's deep concern over the Middle East because, by the way, Plain Truth tells you straight from the shoulder and without any apology, that no matter the trauma we experience today in South Vietnam, those events will be paled into insignificance by American concern over the Middle East in the very near future. And we've been saying that on the radio and the television program for many, many years, and it has already come to pass. As a matter of fact, prior to the withdrawal and the debacle in South Vietnam, that had become a fact of our daily news after U.S. gradual withdrawal and non-involvement in Vietnam, to the point that the Middle East was the one big thing that began coloring our news. Well, Vietnam was the war that simply would not go away. We hoped it was all over back in 1973, but now, like a recurring nightmare, the war in Southeast Asia is once again very much in the news and in our thoughts. And once again, America has shown she does not have the will, the determination, call it what you will, left or right, hawks or doves, anti-war riots and demonstrations, the youngsters who fled our country to Canada, Sweden, and elsewhere to avoid conscription, all of the agony of that war, the war that changed us. But nevertheless, for whatever reason, for whatever causes, and whether you agree with the fact or not, we have proved we do not, right or wrong, have the will to win that war. Vietnam changed us mentally, morally, emotionally, spiritually. It took a grievous toll at home, perhaps as grievous a toll or even more so, as it did on the battlefield. It was the war that curdled the self-assurance of Americans. We entered it quietly confident, we emerged from it full of self-doubts. Our faith in our own rightness and our position in the world had been severely shaken. Vietnam destroyed the myth that an invincible United States had the power and the will to police the world. It diminished American willingness to become involved in any war, in any conflict, anywhere. Vietnam revived dormant yearnings for isolation from foreign troubles. Vietnam destroyed America's feelings that it possessed the values or political ideology to solve the world's problems. Vietnam split the leaders of our nation into polarized groups, into doves or hawks. It shattered a long tradition of bipartisan support for a president's foreign policy. Vietnam made military conscription and the military establishment so unpopular that both parties began calling for an all-volunteer army. Vietnam drained away billions of dollars in energy from giant domestic projects. It raised consumer prices and workers' wages since it was financed largely through an inflated economy, government deficit spending, which we pay for today in runaway inflation and increased joblessness. Vietnam caused the greatest dissent in American history. It ignited riots and demonstrations on campuses, sent draft dodgers to Canada and Sweden. Said Newsweek magazine, the Vietnam War cost America a wound to the spirit, so sore that the news of peace stirred only the relief that comes with an end to pain. A war that produced no famous victories, no national heroes, and no stirring patriotic songs, produced no memorable Armistice Day celebrations either, because America was too exhausted by the war and too dubious of the peace to celebrate. Vietnam severely eroded the confidence the American people had in themselves, their leaders, and their country. In fact, Vietnam drove President Johnson from the White House. The war accelerated the growth of a counterculture turned off on America and turned on to rock music, drugs, free love, alienation, and violence. It reduced debate to a shouting match between those who wore the flag and those who burned them. It produced confrontation between the long hairs and the hard hats. Vietnam inflamed all the strains in contemporary America, between the races, between the classes, and between the generations. It divided Americans against Americans as had never happened since the Civil War. At one point, it stretched the fabric of our society close to the breaking point. It eroded the authority and the credibility of our major institutions, not just government or military, but even business, the universities, religion, and science. Even the CIA did not emerge from Vietnam unscathed, as bitter accusations abounded that the CIA had spied on war protesters. Vietnam typified a growing feeling that gripped Americans everywhere. Problems seemed insoluble. Every effort to alleviate problems only intensified them. There were no easy answers. Somehow, America had lost its way in everything. Vietnam was not the cause of these problems, but it was catalytic. It was the catalyst that inflamed them. Americans were confused, frustrated, and divided at home and abroad because America had no great unified national sense of purpose or values. Everyone seemed to be doing his own thing. Abroad, American prestige sank to new lows as the vaunted U.S. military might was unable to win a decisive victory after years of fighting. In the beginning of the war, Americans thought we had a purpose for fighting in Vietnam. We were going to honor our commitments. We had to stop communist aggression on a distant shore, to aid a helpless country, to ensure that a free people could stay free, to ensure the right of a free people of self-determination, to choose their own government and their own way of life. In the middle of that war, we weren't sure why we were fighting. And at the end of it, almost everyone felt it had been a colossal mistake from the very beginning. We witnessed a painful series of events, My Lai massacres, an innocent napalm child running naked and screaming down a highway, POWs humiliated in a Hanoi Hilton, GIs demoralized by dope, corruption, and poor leadership, and even refusing direct orders by their officers to go into battle. So to paraphrase and reverse Churchill's famous World War II statement, never had so many paid so much for so little. Not only was it the longest war in our history, but it cost us 56,000 killed, combat and other causes, over 300,000 wounded, and about $170 billion. And what do we have to show for it all? Nothing. All the men, all the money, all the sacrifice, all the disillusionment, all in vain. When you think in retrospect of all of those men who died, and literally so many Americans, I imagine there are very few families who do not know someone who was involved directly in the Vietnam War. There were just that many of our people involved. All the guns, the materiel, the weaponry, the hardware of war, the fact that the South Vietnamese Air Force is the fourth largest, or was, in the world, a fact so little known by most people in the world, and yet all of this totally in vain. Of course, with 20/20 vision of hindsight, it's easy to look back in retrospect and see where we went wrong. We violated a well-known military maxim, never get involved in a land war in Asia, attributed to General Stilwell. I wrote a book some time back. It's out of print now. If we decide to resurrect a little of that in retrospect, I think it's a little bit out of date. But it also showed how we had made the mistake of a land war in Asia in Korea by getting involved along a purely imaginary line of a parallel. And the uniqueness of these two involvements of the United States in Asia, I think, is worthy of note, because in both cases we were fighting along an imaginary parallel drawn on a map that recognizes no defensible military areas, such as the confluence of rivers or important road junctions or railways or mountains or valleys or anything of the kind, but is simply drawn across a map. In both cases, there were supposed to be demilitarized zones. In both cases, it was a peninsular war. In both cases, we were fighting on the side of an enemy whose enemy were exactly the same kind of people, with the same language, in most cases the same religion, but who simply had drifted into different political polarities. In both cases, the U.S. 7th Fleet stood offshore. In both cases, United States troops enjoyed air superiority. And in both cases, we lost. We lost in Korea, and we lost in South Vietnam, far worse. So we blundered again by becoming involved in a land war in Asia, notwithstanding what World War II generals had advised. We blundered by fighting piecemeal. United States troops have proved time and again that they can fight a war to end all wars, if that's what they think they're doing. They can fight to preserve democracy. They can fight because of mom and apple pie and the girlfriend and the drugstore and the malted on the corner. They can fight for all the ideals. A lot of us aren't just quite that patriotic. We fight because we have to. We fight because we're told to. We fight because there's nothing else to do. We might fight to make the world safe for democracy, or to prevent a new dark ages, such as the accession of Adolf Hitler to the throne of the entirety of the world. We might fight for all kinds of causes or purposes, but Americans don't know how to fight. To lean on an enemy as an arm of foreign policy to bring an enemy to a conference table. Our military men don't know how to fight piecemeal. To contribute soldiers in bits and pieces to a fray for the purpose of what is called conditioned response. We don't know how. The worst mistake any military leader could tell you is to fight piecemeal, to commit troops to battle piecemeal. You can't win that way. It's like tying one hand of your military force behind its back and then trying to give the enemy safe sanctuary, which we did in Korea, which the men who fought in Korea were so incensed over, that Yalu River and the line, "Don't trespass beyond this in chasing those MiGs." But we did the same thing in Vietnam. So let's speculate for a moment. What would have happened if the United States had originally supported Ho Chi Minh? What would have occurred if, in his desire to create a united, independent, albeit communist Vietnam, we had supported Ho Chi Minh from the beginning? Actually, we started doing precisely that clear back during the Eisenhower administration, a little-known fact to most people. You see, Ho was a nationalist. First and foremost, he was a Vietnamese patriot. Next, he was indeed a communist, a self-admitted one, but a communist educated in Paris, France, and more pro-Russian by far than pro-Chinese in his thinking. Ho would have resisted any outside interference in Vietnam and would have insisted on plotting his own nationalistic course, like Tito did, and incidentally, we virtually forced Tito into the arms of Russia and China. Both Russia and China, in competition for influence in Vietnam, would have had great clashes and problems, and it's quite likely then, had we supported Ho Chi Minh from the beginning, would you believe that Indochina could have been a Russian and a Chinese problem, a headache of giant proportions for them, costing them men and money and materiel instead of ours? I know that sounds shocking to Americans, but if we had supported Ho Chi Minh, we could not possibly have come out any worse than we did. 56,000 dead, and billions, maybe up to 170 billion and more spent, and additional billions lost at the hand of an enemy, plus a divided, disillusioned, turned off America. So as you reflect back, We made one mistake after another. First, we became ensnared by a multitude of alliances. Then we violated an obvious military maxim, don't become involved in a land war in Asia. We blundered by fighting piecemeal. But the greatest mistake of all is one most Americans will never think of. We ignored God. We didn't even think of any great principle of our Creator with regard to our conduct and our foreign policies in the world. We totally ignore God because most people simply don't acknowledge God or believe in Him. And those who do want Him to be an armchair figure that has no real direct intervention in today's global events and American foreign policy in particular. Are we, however, under some sort of a strange curse when you look in retrospect at everything that has happened since World War II, with the United States being kicked and cursed, with the United States being, from one part of the world to the other, the whipping boy for every problem? Why is it that around the world American foreign policy is going sour? Our allies turning against us, NATO fragmenting, Vietnam is lost, down the drain, we didn't win in Korea. Kissinger shuttle diplomacy, apparently a total failure in trying to solve the Middle Eastern crisis. Why is it that around the world, wherever you look, America seems to be losing out? Do you know that the Bible is replete with prophecies of what would happen to us, to any nation, if you'd like to view it that way, if we did not obey the laws of our Creator? You can read those statements. Leviticus 26:19 is one. In the King James Version, it says, I will break the pride of your power. Moffat puts it, I will break the power of which you are so proud. I will make the sky hard as iron and the earth hard as bronze till you spend your strength in vain. And by the way, that current number of the Plain Truth magazine says exactly that right on the cover. And your strength shall be spent in vain. And the articles in that current number have to do with why the Middle Eastern talks collapsed and also Indochina's agony. And these great events are viewed in the light of Bible prophecy. I say that if American leadership knew exactly what biblical prophecy says in the offing for the United States, they would not be making these mistakes. But believe it or not, no matter how much Mr. Ford may say that he seeks God's help, that he prays before coming before the nation on television and before facing Congress with his request for more money, somehow, somewhere, these warnings about blessings if you obey and cursings if you disobey seem to escape even national leaders. It's about time we realize we are under some strange curse in this United States because we are not obeying God. If you want to find out more of where the real cause of our troubles lies, then you need your name on the mailing list of The Plain Truth. This publication comes out twice as often as it used to, with twice the impact. It pulls no punches. It speaks very plainly, as I do on the radio and television programs, about these and other issues that concern us every single day.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.